Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
For word of mouth.
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 Well, definitely.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. In July of 1965, New York City Detective James McDonnell was called to the Western Union office at Grand Central. A man posing as a detective was there with a 14-year-old runaway boy. Apparently, the kid's father suspected something fishy when asked to wire twice the amount necessary to fly the boy home. He then called the cops. McDonnell quickly figured out that the sharply dressed man was impersonating a cop and called for backup. The panicked perp promised McDonnell a much bigger story if he'd go easy on him. That story revealed a nationwide extortion ring of men posing as vice squad, putting the squeeze on prominent gay men who had the money to buy their way out of a potentially public jam. The discovery unlocked a nationwide investigation by the FBI and NYPD, the first known case of law enforcement working on behalf of gay men. Writer William McGowan wrote about the largely unknown story for Slate.com. The title of the article, The Chickens and Bulls, is also the name of the NYPD operation in 1965. McGowan explained those terms when we spoke to him last summer.
Well, chickens and the bulls refers to chickens, first of all, who were often young, underage male prostitutes, some of them runaways, some of them drug addicts, who were put in a position to lure affluent, closeted, usually closeted homosexual men by what were called bulls, or were blackmailers, who would barge into a room or steal the identity, the credentials of a John, and then would, following from that, would try to blackmail the mark.
Mm. Well, give us a little bit of background on this practice of fairy shaking, as was known at the time, frequently carried out by law enforcement.
Well, you have to understand this in the context of the broad societal homophobia of the day. Mm. This was really before anything to do with gay rights had come down, the political highway. It was an era where a married or well-employed, closeted gay man, if unmasked, would risk a career being destroyed, a marriage being wrecked, friendships just thrown over the side, security clearances revoked, professional licenses revoked, academic tenure denied. There were magazines that trafficked in these kind of lurid exposés. Confidential magazine is one of them. But even the mainstream media at the time was fairly homophobic and quite visible about it. The New York Times published a front page cover story in 1963 talking about how the growth of quote-unquote overt homosexuality in New York City provokes widespread concern, mostly among law enforcement officers. In the case of law enforcement was particularly homophobic. There was a practice known as fairy shaking, where law enforcement officers would, if they encountered a gay man who looked like he might be able to pay, and this isn't all, but this is, you know, some. It was a form of the kind of corruption that prevailed at the time. They would engage in blackmailing or taking a cut, and they called that fairy shaking. Law enforcement in general wasn't really concerned about crime against gays and was particularly indifrent to crimes, gay on gay crime. So that all this set the stage for the kind of indifference and hostility to gay men that gave blackmailers a great amount of potential leverage.
So, in other words, it was highly plausible, you know, for these gay men for a vice squad to come barging in if they were in a hotel with somebody.
Well, that's why the criminals were plausible. Not only did the criminals dress like real detectives, they had often had fake shields, knockoffs of real detective shields that looked, you know, in the surprise and panic, that moment of surprise and panic looked incredibly believable, but you know they had the slang, they had the stance, the body language, they had the official arrest forms. These guys even fooled cops, real cops. They brought some of their victims in order to entice them or to encourage them to pay up. They brought them into station houses, they brought them into night court. So these guys were really, really slick. And it wasn't surprising, given that there were real law enforcement officers who were known throughout the gay underworld at that point to engage in this practice of fairy shaking. These real blackmailers were kind of, piggybacking on what was sort of out there in the grapevine.
Right. And then they'd wait until 9 o'clock in the morning and escort them to the bank. Now, how much money would they extort from these victims?
Well, it was victim dependent in some cases. And just to put a finer point on it, not all cases involved waiting online at a bank. I mean, they would shake down some guys for whatever they had, or they would visit them at their homes or at their workplaces. But those that they did shake down in an overnight shakedown, they'd wait till 9 in the morning and they'd stand on the line in the bank. And often they wiped them out entirely. Mm-hmm. Robert Morgenthau, who's the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York at that time and prosecuted the federal end of this case, also became the Manhattan District Attorney afterwards for 35 years. He told me that in some cases they wiped out entire accounts. I found in going through court documents, I found a wide variety of amounts. Some of the men were prominent and very wealthy. Others, were not, but were hanging out in fancy hotels or clubs. I mean, they clip people from anywhere ranging from $500 up to $10,000. And then in the case of one U.S. congressman, I was told by the lead FBI agent involved that they got him for $50,000.
Mm-hmm. William McGowan is with us. He's author of Coloring the News and Gray Lady Down, and recently wrote in Slate about an extortion ring that preyed on, as you mentioned, gay celebrities, some professors, war heroes, even a congressman in the 1950s and 60s. The investigation you detail is fascinating. Now, you spoke to James McDonald, now 89 at length. Manhattan DA Frank Hogan was also involved, and you just mentioned Robert Morgenthau. What was in it for them? Why were they switching sides, so to speak? A lot of cops used to just shake these men down. These guys were working for them.
Well, Virginia, I don't think it was a lot of cops were just shaking them down. I think there were some. But in this particular case, it came across the law enforcement's radar screen because the victims were prominent. There was a class angle to it. And the cops were just really, really angry that all of these people, as one of the investigators I interviewed, the famously named Tobias Fennell, said to me, that these guys were out there shaking down all these prominent people, and these prominent people thought we were doing it, and we were angry at that. It was a tarnish on their gold shields. So that was a factor. And I think, part of it also was a changing zeitgeist. Mm. The Mattachine Society, which was a homophile organization, as it was they were called back then, largely composed of lawyers. They had some influence with the district attorneys and with the Justice Department in terms of these cases would come across to the Mattachine Society, and the Mattachine would then sort of refer them upwards in the food chain. And I think that because of changing attitudes, it was kind of a Mississippi Burning moment. Mm-hmm. If you remember that movie,
yes,
where
I do.
It showed that the Justice Department and the FBI finally cared about the abuses that civil rights workers were suffering in the South in the 1964 Philadelphia and Mississippi killings. This case kind of represents that in terms of gay civil rights. It was just a hinge moment, a crux moment, where it showed attitude shifting, and I think it makes a strong case that in predating Stonewall, which is always seen as the pivotal moment in gay rights, that this shows it's a little bit of a precursor moment.
You mentioned Stonewall, which leads to one of the racketeers themselves, some pretty fascinating characters that we really don't have time to get into. Listeners will have to read up on them. But they were working on some level with some corrupt cops, as you mentioned, not all of them, and other members of the legitimate system, people who were posing in courtrooms. Do you think that they thought that society was on their side? They must not have seen this zeitgeist necessarily.
Who is that?
I'm talking about the racketeers, the Ed Murphys, the John Pines, those who were taking advantage of a system that was pretty much universally on their side at the time.
Oh, absolutely. One of the ringleaders in Chicago, you mentioned his name, John Pine. He was a lieutenant in the Chicago PD's confidential squad. He learned all of his blackmailing tricks from the very blackmailers he put in jail for so many years. So these guys were really hardcore criminals. I mean, think about characters, they're right out of a pulp novel, mm-hmm. a really dark pulp novel of the day. You know, kind of living in fleabag hotels, but living high when they got their cash, knowing how to put leverage and put, you know, a kind of really dark force on somebody and really make them squirm and just sucking dry some of these people in a really horrible, inhuman way, and resulting in the suicide in one case of a very high ranking Navy admiral who wound up being identified as a victim, was approached by Detective McDonald to come up to New York and tell a story to Manhattan District Attorney Frank Hogan. And instead of coming up with McDonald that day, agreed to come up the next day, but instead went to a Bethesda, Maryland hotel and put a bullet in his head. So it was very high stakes and very sad in many kinds of ways.
An amazing story and of the rise and fall, the inevitable and quite incredible fall of this extortion ring. I want to thank you for your time, William McGowan.
Virginia, thank you so much for having me.
William McGowan there, author of Coloring the News and Gray Lady Down. We spoke to him last summer when his expose on the extortion of prominent gay men in the 1960s appeared on Slate.com. We do have a link to the article on this largely unknown story at wordofmouthradio.org.